19. For the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, they use no words, no sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making the wise simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. But who can discern their own errors? Forgive me my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Father, we thank you for everyone who has come out this morning to learn more about you and the evidence for you. We thank you for Southern Evangelical Seminary celebrating 25 years this year, for the leadership of Dr. Lan and the entire SES team who puts this on faithfully every year. We pray for all the speakers that they would speak rightly, and for everyone who is here that they would be able to be edified themselves and be made better ambassadors for you in Christ's name. Amen. Ladies and gentlemen, before we get into this morning's session, I want you to take a look at your resource bags for a second, the plastic bags that you should have. And everything that we are going to do here for the next 2 days is actually on the app. It is the NCCA app, and on this sheet that says welcome on it, it'll show you how to download the app. In fact, you can scan it if you have a scanner right there on your iPhone or your Droid, or if you're one of the four people in the world with a Windows phone, it should work there too. And if you scan it, you will have the entire 2 days right there on your iPhone. You can see what we're doing here. You can see what's coming up next. All the breakouts, they're right there. So download the SES NCCA 2017 app. And they never tell you to do this in church, but take out your iPhone right now and do it. Okay, so you have it. This event would not be possible without the Green Company, who has sponsored this entire event, and also the American Family Association, who is a co-sponsor of this event, along with Southern Evangelical Seminary. And there are many other sponsors that you can see out there in the hallway. So let's give our sponsors a round of applause for making this possible. As you interact with the app, by the way, you can get points for the drawing tomorrow afternoon, where we're going to give away a free iPad. It's a 1995 iPad. It's Dr. Lan has had it that long, and he's trying to get a new one, so we're going to give that one away. No, it's actually a new iPad, so you want to look into that. And the entire theme, as you know, of our 2 days together is pursuing a faith that thinks. That's what we're going to do here, hopefully, this morning and for the next 2 days together. There's a full schedule today, as you know, and in this room, is it in this room tonight, Dr. Lan, the debate, or will it be in the Crown Room? It's going to be here? It's going to be in this room tonight. Dr. Richard Howe from Southern Evangelical Seminary will be debating for the good guys. And Dan Barker, who we will shower with love, is going to be arguing for the bad guys. He'll be up here as well. So tonight, after the after dinner, we're going to have a debate in this room. You don't want to miss that. And then, of course, a full day tomorrow as well. And there are some amazing speakers here. I know that you're not going to be able to attend all the breakouts, so there is an opportunity for you to get all of the breakouts, either in audio, some of them in video, at the booth out there. So avail yourselves of that, because you don't want to miss anything that goes on here at the conference this week. All right. Are you guys ready to go? I want to talk about your most important thinking skill. And the reason I want to talk about this is I've noticed in doing this for quite a while that there is one thinking skill more than any other that you need in order to be effective in showing that Christianity is true and why other worldviews are false. I personally use this over and over again. And as I say, it is the most important thinking skill. If you can get a handle on this thinking skill, I say this to audiences all the time, half of what you need to know, you're going to know. Half. Just this one thinking skill. Because if you can apply this, you're going to be able to point out that many of the ideas that come against Christianity are false. And that's half the battle. Just figuring out what's false so you can pursue what's true. Now, Jesus famously said that the truth will set you free. What does that imply? If the truth will set you free, if you don't have the truth, you're somehow in bondage. Do you see the implication of that? If the truth will set you free, you say, what am I free from? If you don't have the truth, you're in bondage. And our culture wants to take you down intellectual cul-de-sacs to divert you from the truth. Satan wants to do that. He wants to take you away from the truth. And there are so many false philosophies and worldviews out there that half of what you need to do is just show why those aren't true. You know, Peter has said, always be ready to give an answer for the hope that you have, for the reason that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. That's 1 Peter 3:15. Now, the gentleness and respect thing is hard for me because I'm originally from New Jersey. Okay? But we're supposed to give a reason for the hope that we have. But we're not only supposed to give a reason for the hope that we have, we're also supposed to show why worldviews that are opposed to the Christian faith, ideas that are opposed to the Christian faith, are false. That's why Paul in 2 Corinthians 10:5, we have a very sophisticated audience here, I can see. In 2 Corinthians 10:5, where Paul is talking about false teachers, he says, we demolish arguments and take every thought captive to Christ. So we're not just supposed to show why Christianity is true, we're supposed to show why other worldviews are false. And I'd like to try and do that, or at least give you the tools to do that here this morning. And in order to start this, we're going to talk about something called the law of non-contradiction, which helps us discover what is false. And the law of non-contradiction says opposite ideas cannot both be true at the same time and in the same sense. For example, the earth can't be both round and not round at the same time and in the same sense. Right? I mean, it's either round or it's not round, but it's not both. You with me so far? Now, some people will say, okay, Frankie, I get that. That seems pretty self-evident. It's just one of the fundamental laws of logic. But the law of non-contradiction does not apply to religious claims. That's what they'll say anyway. You know, religion is in the realm of value, whereas science and all these other things are in the realm of fact. So you might as well not even talk about this with regard to religion. Let me point out why that is a false statement. First of all, you're using the law of non-contradiction right there to say that. But let's just be very practical. The man here on the left is Richard Dawkins. He is an Oxford professor whom you probably know as one of the more famous atheists in the world. He wrote the book, The God Delusion. He thinks you're deluded if you believe in God. He says God does not exist. Of course, the man on the right is Oxford professor John Lennox, who says God does exist. And these two gentlemen, by the way, have had several debates. You can see them on YouTube. In fact, I don't know if you know Lennox. Maybe many of you in here do. John Lennox is the most likable apologist person you'll ever meet. He's a jovial Irishman. He is brilliant. He's always smiling. He's one of these guys like your favorite uncle. He has all these little quips and jokes that you just... He's adorable. He's just an adorable man, okay? Whereas on the other hand, Richard Dawkins, as you can see here, can come across as a bit of a sourpuss. And when these two men debated, one reviewer said, watching John Lennox debate Richard Dawkins was like watching Santa Claus debate the devil. I'll leave that for you to judge. You can download the debate or watch the debate. But here is my only question when it comes to this particular issue. Does God exist or does God not exist? Can both of these men be right? No, they both can't be right. If Dawkins is right, Lennox is wrong. If Lennox is right, then Dawkins is wrong. But they're both not right and they're both not wrong. Right? You with me? So who's right here? You guys are having trouble. Yeah, it's Lennox. All right? There's evidence that Lennox is right. But the only point I want to make here is that this law of non-contradiction applies to every claim, religious claims or not. Now, a few years ago, I was at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is about as excited about Christianity as UCal Berserkly, as you know. And this was actually the Q&A line that night. And one gentleman got up to the microphone. We were doing I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. He got up to the microphone, and I had just given evidence that God exists. I had just given evidence that there's a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator who created all things and sustains all things. And this man got up to the microphone, and he was wearing this T-shirt. Bad religion. So I knew this man was open-minded. And after I'd gone through the evidence, he said, can you tell me anything else that is spaceless, timeless, and immaterial other than God that exists? And I said, yes, the laws of logic. And he said, well, I would say then that the laws of logic don't exist. And I said, so you're saying they do exist? And he said, no, I'm saying they don't. I said, so you're saying they do exist? He said, no, I'm saying they don't. So you're saying they do exist? No, they don't. How am I saying they do? You're using them right now to contradict what I'm saying. You're using the law of non-contradiction right now in order to say it doesn't exist. You can't avoid it. And he said, well, he eventually got to the point where he said, these laws, then, are just human conceptions. In other words, are you saying we just invent them in our minds? And if human beings didn't exist, they wouldn't exist? He said, yeah, that's right. I said, okay, let me ask you a question. Let's go back to the point before there were any human beings on the earth. There were no human beings. Question, was the statement, there are no human beings on the earth, true? He didn't like that. He had a rambling response, but he finally admitted, yeah, it would be true. You see, the laws of logic are grounded in a mind, just not human minds. In fact, if the laws of logic didn't exist, we couldn't even communicate. You couldn't understand a word I'm saying right now. And if you just had your own private idea of the laws of logic, and I just had my own private ideas of the laws of logic, we couldn't communicate. There would have to be an immaterial, objective, unchanging standard beyond us for us to communicate at all. We didn't create the laws of logic. We use the laws of logic, but we didn't create them. The laws of logic are a bridge between our minds. We didn't create the bridge, but we walk over it all the time in order to communicate with one another. And the law of non-contradiction is one of the foundational laws of logic. In fact, there was a great Muslim philosopher a number of years ago. His name was Avicenna. And he had a great way of convincing those who denied the law of non-contradiction that they were wrong. He put it this way. He said, anyone who denies the law of non-contradiction should be beaten and burned. Until he admits to be beaten is not the same as not to be beaten. And to be burned is not the same as not to be burned. Being beaten is not the same as not being beaten. And being burned is not the same as not being burned. Now, let me just say that this tactic is not endorsed by Southern Evangelical Seminary. Okay, but you get the idea. Yes, I'm a graduate of SES, and we have not done this to that point yet. Or to this point yet. Now, what I'm going to do, since this is about one thinking skill, is I'm going to show how, at least I'm going to try and show, how to apply this skill to virtually every false view you see in the culture today. And you're going to be absolutely sick of this by the time we're done. You're going to be, Frank, that's enough. Knock it off. This is called a one-point sermon. All right? There's only one point. But it's so important that if you get it, you're going to use it for the rest of your life. By the way, I didn't even know this thinking skill until I was 33 years old. I already had a master's degree and I didn't know this. I had to come to SES to learn this. I first heard it from Barry Leventhal, who heard it from Norman Geisler, who heard it directly from God. And here it is. By the way, whatever Dr. Geisler writes, God reads. Did you know that? Gee, I didn't know that. So let's just apply it to the most common, one of the most common claims you hear in our culture today, and it's this one. There is no truth. Now, you guys are sophisticated in here. Most of you are apologetics junkies. I get it. You already know this. If you don't know this off the top of your head, what would you say to somebody who said something like this? There is no truth. You haven't heard anyone refute this yet. Yeah, you would say, hey, is that true? Is it true that there's no truth? Because if it's true that there's no truth, the claim there is no truth can't be true. But it claims to be true. Did I say that right? This is known as a self-defeating statement. And the thinking skill that you have to get good at is you've got to get good at turning the claim on itself. Turn the claim on itself. For those of you who have read I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, you know in the book, Dr. Geisler and I call this the Roadrunner tactic. You can get the book to figure out why, but this is the Roadrunner tactic. And if you get the Roadrunner tactic into your DNA, half of what you need to know, you already know. Because you will analyze statements from other people, and you will see very quickly that the statement that they're saying is self-defeating. What's a self-defeating statement in addition to there is no truth? If I were to say I can't speak a word in English, what would you say? See, that's self-defeating. It's a self-defeating statement. If I were to say my parents had no kids that lived, or my brother is an only child, or everything I say is a lie. Some of you will get that tomorrow. Or all generalizations are false. Some of you will never get that one, all right? These are known as self-defeating statements. And the way that you can detect a self-defeating statement is to simply turn the claim on itself. And the main point that I want to get across here today, can you see that this statement shoots itself? Can you see that? It can't be true that there's no truth. It defeats itself. Now we're going to go through a whole number of these. And again, you're going to get tired of this, but repetition is the mother of skill. The more you see this, the more it'll become part of you. Here's the postmodern claim. It's very close to the one we just went over. And that is, there's no such thing as absolute truth. If somebody says that to you, what are you going to say to them? Is that absolutely true? If you want to have some fun, say, hey, are you absolutely sure? How about this? You hear this a lot. It's true for you, but not for me. Yes. It's a little bit more subtle, but it's still self-defeating. If somebody says it's true for you, but not for me, say, hey, is that true for everybody? Is true for you, but not for me, true for everybody? Because if true for you, but not for me, is true for everybody, then true for you, but not for me, can't be true because it's true for everybody. Did I say that right? I know that can give you intellectual constipation if you think about it. But that's because it's self-defeating. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. Actually, there's a more fun way of dealing with this. If somebody says it's true for you but not for me, say, sure, go try that with your bank teller. Yeah, go to your bank teller one day and say, look, I need some extra money out of my account. I'd like $100,000. The bank teller looks at your account and says, I'm sorry, I only have $6.14 in your account. Never fear, it's very easy to get the money. You simply say, ha, that's true for you but not for me. Give me the $100,000. Are you going to get the money? No, if it's true, there was only $6.14 in your account. That's true for all people at all times in all places when referring to your account at that time. Or let's say you're going a little fast down Highway 485 here. You're going 90 in a 65. Cop sees you, pulls you over, walks up to your car, knocks on the glass, you put the window down. He goes, you were going 90 in a 65. Never fear, it's easy to get out of a ticket. You simply look back up at him and you go, ha! That's true for you, but not for me. And you speed away. He can't give you a ticket if it's not true for you. No, if it's true you were going 90, that's true for everybody when referring to you at that time. Truth is what corresponds to its referent, or what corresponds to reality. Or we could say, you know what truth is? Truth is seeing reality as God sees it. That's what truth is. And if you were going 90, God saw it! Now, many of us in this room do apologetics presentations around the country, as you know, and a lot of times I'll go to a church and I'll say, do you guys believe the Bible is true? And most people will say, well, yeah. And then I'll say, well, why do you think it's true? You know what most people will say, or at least a lot of people will say? They'll say, because I have faith. Is that a good reason? Does your faith change whether or not God exists or Jesus rose from the dead or the Bible's true? No, it doesn't change a thing about those things. I mean, do you have to believe something to make it true? Do you have to believe in gravity to stay on the ground? Do people who don't believe in gravity float away? Hey, look, there's another one. Hey, if you believe, you'll come back. No, that's not the way it works. You say, well, why is the Bible always talking about faith then? Because there's two kinds of faith. There's belief that, and then there's belief in. Belief that is getting evidence that God exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, that the Bible is true. That's what we do at this seminary, Southern Evangelical Seminary. That's what we do here at the conference. But all the belief that in the world won't get your moral transgressions forgiven. To go and get those transgressions forgiven, you have to go from belief that to belief in. You know, James, the half-brother of Jesus who wrote that little book in the New Testament called, you guys are very sophisticated, said even the demons believe that God exists, but they tremble. They know he exists intellectually better than we do, but they don't trust in him. If you want to have your transgressions forgiven, you have to go from belief that to belief in. To trust in. God won't force you to do that. He can't force love. We know this in relationships, right? There's a difference between belief that and belief in. You can believe that somebody be a good spouse. Doesn't mean you're trusting in them. In fact, when I first met my wife 32 years ago, I got evidence that she would be a good wife. But all the evidence in the world didn't make her my wife. I had to take a step of trust in her to ask her to be my wife. And in a momentary lapse of judgment, she said yes. That's the difference between belief that and belief in. But don't buy into this idea that things can be true for you but not for me. And that just by trusting in it, it's true. No, it's not necessarily true just because you trust in it. But if it is true, you ought to trust in it. If Jesus really is God, you ought to trust in him for your salvation. Of course, if you say this, you may run into somebody like this. A pluralist. Because turning the claim on itself defeats pluralism, too. People will say things like, all religious beliefs are true. Now, you can refute this one easily by just giving somebody a counterexample. Like, you could, if you wanted to be, like, from New Jersey or something, you could say something like this. My religious belief is that you're going to hell. Is my belief true? That wouldn't be very nice, would it? But how do you think that guy would respond to that? No, he would say that's not true. Well, I guess then all religious beliefs aren't true. It's just shown false by counterexample. Of course, religious beliefs are mutually exclusive, right? They can't all be true. You always hear this, these people say this stuff all the time. All religions teach basically the same thing. Oh, they teach that you ought to all, you know, you ought to love one another. Oh, they do. Well, most of them do, not all of them. You know, some forms of Islam don't teach you ought to love one another. Satanism doesn't teach you ought to love one another. But let's just say there's a common moral code underneath all religions. Okay, you might be able to say that. That might be more of God's natural revelation on people rather than special revelation. But let's just say that's true. Religions teach that you ought to love one another. They only differ on the nature of man, the nature of God, sin, salvation, heaven, hell, and creation. Outside of that, they're all exactly the same. They're superficially the same and fundamentally different. And most world religions are trying to get you to do this and do that so you can work your way to God. The true world religion says, no, you don't work your way to God. God works his way to you. He comes down from heaven, puts humanity over his deity, lives the perfect life in our place, takes our punishment on himself and says, do you want my sacrifice? You just trust in him and your sins, your moral transgressions are forgiven. So where all other religions are do this and do that, Christianity's done. Just trust in him. The same kind of guy might talk about multiculturalism. You shouldn't try to convert people because all cultures are the same. What would you say to somebody who says this? Yeah, then why are you trying to convert me? You notice that? That person is giving an ought. He's trying to convert this individual to multiculturalism. You know, it amazes me today. There are people out there who are talking about how all cultures are the same, that you shouldn't judge any of them. But the one culture or the one worldview they will not tolerate is what? Christianity. Somehow Christianity is inferior. What standard they have to judge all this, I don't know. But if all religions are the same, why would they be down on Christianity? Or why would they be down on the foundational ideals of America if all cultures are the same? How about liberalism? Yeah, it works on that too. You shouldn't impose your morality on others. You hear that all the time from political liberals. What's the problem with the claim? Turn the claim on itself, then say this. Then why are you imposing your morality on me? You see, this is a moral position. You shouldn't. You ought not. And they're imposing it on you. Now, when people say this to me, when they say, hey, you shouldn't impose your morality on others, normally I say, why not? Would that be immoral? It's a moral position, right? But you could also say this. Look, this isn't my morality. Look, I didn't make this stuff up. I didn't make up the fact that murder's wrong, that abortion's wrong, that rape is wrong, that theft is wrong, that men were made for women and women were made for men, and the best way to perpetuate and stabilize society is to recognize legally that relationship over any other relationship. I didn't make any of this up. This isn't my morality. This is just the morality. It's not mine. It's not yours. It's the. It's the one Thomas Jefferson said was self-evident. It's the one that Paul said in Romans chapter 2, the Gentiles who do not have the law written on their hearts. Everybody knows basic right and wrong, just some people don't want to live by it. So it's not my morality, it's not your morality, it's the morality. So that's what we ought to legislate. And by the way, no extra charge for this, all laws legislate morality. Right? The only question is whose morality? And I say, don't legislate yours, don't legislate mine, let's just legislate the. And we know what the is on the big issues. How about determinism? This is Francis Crick, who basically said, my thoughts are determined completely by the non-rational laws of physics. He had a book called The Astonishing Hypothesis that he wrote just before he died, because you always have to write books before you die. And that's basically his thesis. Is that all of our thoughts are determined by the non-rational laws of physics. Now, if someone were to say this to you, what would you say to Crick? Turn the claim on itself. What would you say? Yeah, you would say, then so is that thought. So why should we believe that or anything else you say? You see, this is the fundamental Achilles heel of materialism today, of physicalism, of determinism, of atheism. They think we're just moist robots. We're just molecular machines. Well, if we're just moist robots or molecular machines, then why should we believe the thought that we are just moist robots or molecular machines? Because that thought came to us not by intelligence, but by the laws of physics. So why should we trust it? You see the problem here? That's the fundamental problem today with materialism, determinism, or atheism. And most atheists today are materialists. We talk a lot about this in the book Stealing from God. So if you want to go further into this particular topic, get the book Stealing from God on the cross-examine table back there. And by the way, all of these self-defeating positions we're going through are in a PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to show you how to download for free at the end. So if I'm going too quickly here, you're just too slow. No. If I'm going too quickly here, you'll get them at the end. By the way, I should have warned you up front, since I am from New Jersey, you cannot listen in Southern. All right? You can't listen in Southern. You got to pick up the pace. We're moving quickly here. It not only works for determinism, does the Roadrunner tactic, or turning a claim on itself, it works also for skepticism. You should doubt everything. What's the problem with this? Turn the claim on itself. Somebody says you should doubt everything, what would you say? Yeah, should I doubt that? You see, why are skeptics skeptical of everything but skepticism? They're not skeptical of skepticism, they think it's true. Philip Johnson, who wrote the seminal book, Darwin on Trial, said, he who is a believer, or he put it this way, he who is skeptical of one set of beliefs is a true believer in another set of beliefs. Those who say Christianity is false are true believers in some non-Christianity viewpoints. And so you just need to point that out. Now, let me ask you guys a question about skepticism or doubts. How many people in here sometimes doubt that what you believe is true? I don't care if you're an atheist or a Christian or anywhere in between. Raise your hand. Look, if you're not doubting, you're probably not thinking. I wake up a lot and go, is this stuff really true? You ever do that? You wake up one morning and you go, I don't know if this stuff is true. Other days I'm going, yep, solid. Everything's great. But when I start doubting, you know what I realize? I realize that most of my doubts are emotional. They're not intellectual. In other words, I'm having a bad day, so I don't think Christianity's true. If I'm having a good day, everything's fine. The evidence for Christianity is excellent, very good. But it's me. I'm just having a bad day. I don't think it's true. Another day, it's great. It's true. Another day, bad day. Not true, not sure. Another day, good. Another day, bad. What's changing, me or the evidence? I'm changing. The evidence hasn't changed a bit. So what I realize I ought to start doing is I ought to start doubting my doubts, because the evidence is very good. In fact, let me ask the question this way. Let's say for the sake of argument, Christianity is true. It is. Let's just say for the sake of argument, it is, even if you doubt it is. Does your psychological state change the fact that Christianity is true? No, you hear people say, I lost my faith. I almost feel like saying, so what? So you lost your faith. Does that mean it's not true? No, your psychological state has just changed. But your psychological state doesn't change the fact that God exists and Jesus rose from the dead, or that the Bible is true. It doesn't change it at all. So instead of concentrating on your psychology, you ought to concentrate on the evidence. Because the evidence is what will reveal what is true, not your psychology. So if you start doubting your doubts, you're back to knowing something for sure. Have you guys thought about doubting your doubts? I doubt it. Very closely aligned to skepticism is something called Kantism. That's what we're calling it anyway. Immanuel Kant, who said you can't know the real world. This is how you know what Immanuel Kant thought. Now, what's the problem with Kant's view? If Kant says you can't know the real world, what would you ask him? Yeah, then how can he know that about the real world? Why can Kant know about the real world, but we can't? And by the way, all modern philosophy goes through Kant. If you buy into Kant, then you're locked in agnosticism, or you're stuck in agnosticism. You can't know. The problem is that Kant's view is self-defeating. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. It's like saying I can't know anything. If you say you can't know anything, you're going to ask that person, how do you know you can't know? It's a self-defeating position. And unfortunately, most modern philosophy buys into Kant. That's why it's self-defeating. But the easy thing about this is once you know this roadrunner tactic, once you know how to turn a claim on itself, once you know this one thinking skill you need to know, you can point out that this can't be true. And so you can move on. How about scientism? You hear this when you go to college. There's no truth in anything but science. No truth in anything but science. What's the problem with this claim? So how would you refute it? If someone were to say there's no truth in anything but science, how could you show that this can't be true? Yeah, simply ask the person the question, is that a scientific truth? Can you go in the laboratory and prove that? No, that's a philosophical claim. You can't prove that by science. In fact, you can't do anything without philosophy. Science is built on philosophy. Reading the Bible is built on philosophy. You can't understand the Bible without philosophy. You can't understand science without philosophy. You can't understand anything without philosophy. Where's Richard Howe? He should be cheering this right now. Because everything is built on thinking. And that's what philosophers do. In the book Stealing from God, we have a whole chapter on this. The title of the chapter is Science Doesn't Say Anything, Scientists Do. You see, all data needs to be gathered, and all data needs to be interpreted. And who does that? Scientists. If there were no human beings, would there be anything known as science? No. Science is a method of inquiry that human beings use to discover cause and effect relationships. And human beings have to gather the data and then interpret the data. And they do that through philosophy. After they gather the evidence, they go, what's the best explanation for this evidence? That involves thinking. In fact, science is more done in the mind than in the lab. And of course, you couldn't know anything unless you understood philosophy. Now, very closely related to scientism is something we're calling humism. Not humanism, but humism. David Hume, another philosopher who died in 1776, and Hume said, only self-evident or empirically verifiable claims are meaningful. What's the problem with this claim? Yes, is that claim self-evident or empirically verifiable? In fact, Dr. Geister, when he was going through his graduate program many years ago, I think it was in Chicago at Loyola, had a professor who really bought into this claim. And he wanted to have all these students do a paper on different aspects of Hume's philosophy. And he asked Dr. Geister to do the first one. And he said, you got 20 minutes to do your critique of Hume. He said, Dr. Geister, it won't take that long. So he got up there and he said, David Hume says that only self-evident and empirically verifiable claims are meaningful. Since that claim is not self-evident or empirically verifiable, then it's not meaningful. So it's self-defeating and therefore can't be true. And then he sat down. Now, the professor was not pleased. Because the entire premise of the entire course had been upstaged by the very first presenter. But that's what you can do with the love of Jesus. All right. Also, this tactic undermines Ehrmanism. You guys know who this guy is? Bart Ehrman, who teaches at UNC Chapel Hill, wrote the book Misquoting Jesus, several other books, Skeptical of Christianity. In fact, he started out, he says, as an evangelical and ultimately is now an agnostic leaning toward atheism. And he says the reader determines the meaning. In fact, he was at SES in 2009 to debate Mike Lacona on did Jesus rise from the dead? I think that was the topic. In fact, little inside baseball, we all went to dinner with Dr. Ehrman over here at Macaroni Grill, right around the corner. Ms. Me and Dr. Tom Howe, and I think Richard Howe was there, and Mike Lacona, and a few other folks. And we got talking to Dr. Ehrman, very pleasant guy. We got talking to him, and at some point in the conversation, he said, who isn't a postmodernist? And all of us at the table went,
we're not. And I said, Dr. Ehrman, postmodernism is self-defeating. He said, it's not that simple. I go, no, it is. It is that simple. To say there's no truth is a truth claim. Defeats itself. Anyway, during the debate, well, actually at the end of the debate, during the Q&A, Ehrman had kept claiming that when the New Testament writers wrote down the manuscript evidence, when they copied it, they actually changed it, because to read and copy down the New Testament text is to change it. That was his claim. This is also called deconstructionism for you philosophically minded folks in here. And Tom Howe, one of our professors here, raised his hand during the Q&A and said, well, Dr. Ehrman, when I read your book, when I read it, am I changing it? Right? Ehrman doesn't think that his claim applies to his own book, just the Bible, right? In effect, what Tom said, should I determine the meaning of that? If I read your claim that the reader determines the meaning, should I determine the meaning of that? If so, I could say, well, the reader doesn't determine the meaning. And Ehrman would say, no, I'm saying it does. No, I get to determine it, Dr. Ehrman, not you. You see the problem here? And so Ehrman knew he was in a self-defeating quandary here. So you know what he said to Tom? He said, Dr. Howe, I'll be happy to send you an email about this to explain it more. And Tom said, when I read your email, would I be changing it? This same tactic, the Roadrunner tactic, turning the claim on itself, works on Hawkingism as well, who famously said on page 5 of his latest book, The Grand Design, philosophy is dead. Now, what do you think somebody like Tom Howe would say to this? Turn the claim on itself. Is that your philosophy? In fact, he says on page 5, philosophy's dead, then most of the rest of the book is all atheistic, materialistic philosophy. Well, if philosophy's dead, then so is his. You can't avoid it. Also, free will is an illusion, he says in the book. This is what Hawking said. Now, what do you think somebody like Tom Howe would say if free will is an illusion? I think he'd say, I stole your credit card number. I don't have free will. It's all an illusion. So you can't blame me for this, right? Actually, no. The proper way to respond to that is to say, did you come to that freely? If free will is an illusion, then are you saying that everything you think, including that free will is an illusion? See, that would be an illusion as well, right? Because you didn't come to it freely. Again, this is the problem with atheistic materialism. You know what atheists do? They exempt themselves from their own theories. That's what they do. They have this theory that every thought we have is the result of the laws of physics. Except my thought is not the laws of, or my thoughts are not the result of the laws of physics, just yours. Free will is an illusion. But except my free will. My free will is not an illusion. In fact, in order to know you're in an illusion, what would you have to see? Or let me put it a different way. In order to know you're having a dream, how are you aware it's just a dream? What has to happen? You gotta wake up. You gotta get outside of the dream to know, oh, that was just a dream. In order to know that free will is an illusion, you'd have to get outside of your own free will to say, my free will is an illusion. You'd have to get some sort of super perspective like God has in order to see that it's just an illusion. So that doesn't work either. It also works on what I call sillyism from Daniel Dennett. This is closely related. He says consciousness is an illusion. One wonders if he was conscious when he wrote this. In fact, you could just come along and say, were you conscious when you said that? Again, in order to see that your consciousness is an illusion, you'd have to get some kind of super consciousness in order to say the consciousness that we mere mortals have is just an illusion. But then you'd have to be God. This is Daniel Dennett, by the way, who's one of the new atheists who teaches at Tufts University. All right. So Dennett doesn't think his consciousness is an illusion, does he? No, he thinks his consciousness is real. In fact, he needs his consciousness in order to write books, so in those books he could say that consciousness is an illusion. You see the self-defeating nature of this? Also, trollism. You see this on the internet. That's just your interpretation. Now, if somebody says that's just your interpretation, what are you going to say to them? Is that just your interpretation? Do you see? Of course it's my interpretation, but that doesn't mean my interpretation's wrong. You've got your interpretation, I've got my interpretation, but that doesn't mean there is no proper interpretation or there's no proper reality. You're talking about how we know something, but the it we're trying to know really exists, independent of what you or I think about it. So, and sometimes this is put this way, sometimes it's said, well, you're just playing word games with me. You know, all these self-defeating claims. If somebody says, you're just playing word games with me, what would you say to them? Is that a word game? That you're playing back with me? No, it's not a word game. This is logic. And if you want to deny logic, A, you're going to have to use logic to do it, and B, there's no hope for you. Yes, emotion makes life delicious, but logic makes life safe. You can do a lot of things that aren't logical that'll be fun in the short term, but in the long term, it's a disaster. Logic is important. This also deals with, by the way, you guys sick of these yet? You can get sick of doing this, but you just got to drill it into your head, because after you have it in your head and it becomes almost second nature to you, half of what you need to know, you're already going to know. It also works for who made Godism. Oh, yeah, who made God? That's what Richard Dawkins said to John Lennox in the debate. Oh, yeah, you're saying God made the universe? Well, who made God? End of debate. Was it really the end of the debate? No, you know what Dawkins famously said, or I should say Lennox famously said? He didn't put it this way, but I like the oh, yeah in front. Oh, yeah? If the universe made you, then who made the universe? You see the point here? When Lennox says God made the universe, Dawkins is saying, well, you need somebody to make God. But then Dawkins comes along and says, well, the universe made me through evolution. So Lennox just turns it around and says, well, if you need a cause for everything, then who made the universe? Of course, the law of causality doesn't say everything needs a cause. What does the law of causality say? Everything that comes to be needs a cause. There's got to be something that's uncaused out there. There's got to be something out there whose essence equals his existence. Something that just is. The being that just is. The being that is uncaused. Look, it's either the universe or something that transcends the universe. All the evidence shows that the universe had a beginning. So there must be something that transcends the universe that didn't have a beginning. Something that's spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, a creator, whose every attribute is infinite. Who is complete, what we call actuality, has no potential for any change, is what we might say is maxed out. That being must exist in order for anything to exist. This is what we teach at Southern Evangelical Seminary, by the way, ses.edu, for those of you that don't know. By the way, has anyone in here ever taken an online course from SES? 12 of us. Why not more? You ought to do that. You can sit in your pajamas at home and take the online course. Just don't ask questions via video when you do that. So spaceless, timeless. By the way, if you're timeless, do you have a beginning? Like, how do you answer the who made God? Well, one way to say, look, if you're timeless, do you have a beginning? No, you don't have a beginning if you're timeless. You always existed. Now, the Bible calls the being that is self-existing, the great I am. And Jesus actually used that in John 8:58 when he's talking to the Pharisees. He says, before Abraham was born, I am. And they immediately picked up stones to stone him. Why? Who is he claiming to be? He's claiming to be Yahweh. What's that a quotation from? I am. It's from the burning bush, Exodus 3:14. Do you remember when God appeared to Charlton Heston? Moses says to God, who should I tell the Israelites you are? And God says, tell them I am send you. What does I am mean? I am means the self-existent eternal one. The being that had no beginning, the being that will have no end, the being that just bees. That just is. The foundation of everything else. That being. So when Richard Dawkins asks who made God, the answer is nobody. God is the uncreated creator, the unmoved mover. Aristotle knew there had to be an unmoved mover. And Aristotle thought the universe was eternal. It's not even dependent on the beginning of the universe. He says if there's change, there's got to be an unchanging source of that change. That got everything moving and keeps it moving. Of course, Aquinas picked this up in the 1200s. And use some of Aristotle's thinking to say, here are some ways to show that there's a God, a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, infinite being. So who made Godism? It works on that too. How about gapism? There are still gaps, but science will find the answers. In fact, I had this situation at University of Michigan. Where after I went through the evidence that there was a beginning to the universe, some atheist got up to the microphone and said, give science more time, and we're going to find an answer to who created all of nature. His name was John. I said, John, we're never going to find a natural cause for all of nature. He said, no, give science more time. We will. I said, no, John, you're never going to find a natural cause for all of nature. He said, no, give science more time, we will. I said, first of all, John, that sounds a lot like faith. Right? Just wait, it'll happen. That's a faith position. And secondly, you're never going to find a natural cause for all of nature. That would be like me saying, look, if you give me more time, one day I'm going to figure out that I gave birth to my own mother. No, you can't do that in principle. If all of nature had a beginning, whatever created nature can't be made of nature, right? In other words, whatever created space, matter, and time, and even the atheists are admitting this. I mean, Stephen Hawking said almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Well, if space, matter, and time had a beginning out of nothing, whatever created space, matter, and time can't be made of space, matter, and time, right? In other words, the cause must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent, to create the universe out of nothing. If that's the case, and it seems to be, it is, the cause can't be made of space, matter, and time. So you're never going to find a natural cause for all of nature. And in fact, the one who says this all the time, when somebody brings up science is going to find all the answers, is Richard Howe, who will be debating here tonight. He'll say, that's faith. It's the natural law of the gap fallacy. I'm going to one day find a natural law that's going to explain everything. Well, first of all, no, you're not, in principle, for the reason we just mentioned. But secondly, where do laws come from? They come from lawgivers, right? Why are there natural laws at all? Why are there? You ever wonder why the universe is so orderly and so precise? Why things keep going in the same direction? Why we can build a spaceship here on Earth and launch it and know that 9 years later it's going to pass within 7,000 miles of Pluto? Why can we do that? Because we can rely on the laws of nature to do what they do consistently and persistently. Because this universe is put together and sustained by a mind. Some atheists will say, oh no, it's just random. You wouldn't even know what random was unless you knew what order was. And you wouldn't know what order was unless there was an orderer out there. How about this? It also works for stealing from Godism. Richard Dawkins again. This is a quote from him, by the way. He says, in an atheist world, there isn't any justice. There is no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Yet on the other hand, in the same book, well actually the quote is from The God Delusion, this quote is from a previous book, but it's still Richard Dawkins. What he says is that the God of the Old Testament is unjust. Well wait a minute, Richard, if there's no justice, how can the God of the Old Testament be unjust? You have to steal a standard of justice from God in order to accuse him. in order to argue against him. You're stealing from God to argue against him. You have to sit in God's lap to slap his face. And this is what atheists do over and over again. They steal from God while claiming he doesn't exist. That's what the whole Stealing from God book is about, if you want to go further. But maybe the most important current cultural trend that the law of non-contradiction, the roadrunner tactic, turning a claim on itself, refutes, is what I call wimpism. Which for many is Christianity now. You ought not judge. First of all, before we look at what Jesus said about this, what's the problem logically with the claim? It's a judgment. Somebody says you ought not judge, you ought to say, then why are you judging me for judging? You see, it's a judgment to say you ought not judge. Everybody makes judgments. Now, by the way, did Jesus say don't judge? No, what did he say? He said, judge not, lest you be judged by the same standard you judge others, you be judged by that standard. So before you try and take the speck out of your brother's eye, take the log out of your own eye first, then you'll be better able to help your brother. Is Jesus telling us not to judge here? No, he's telling us to take the speck out of our brother's eye. That involves making a judgment. He's simply saying, get that problem out of your life first so you can better help your brother. So Jesus is saying, judge yourself first before you judge somebody else. In other words, it's not a command not to judge, it's a command on how to judge. Don't judge hypocritically. If you've got that problem in your life, get it out of your life first so you can better help your brother. In fact, it would be complete suicide to say don't make judgments. Why? It's a judgment itself. And secondly, you have to make judgments every... You had to make 100 judgments just getting over here this morning, didn't you? Everybody makes... Atheists make judgments. What judgments do they make? Well, there is no God. Christianity's wrong. Jesus didn't rise from the dead. You're wrong if you're a Christian. These are all judgments. Everybody makes judgments. The question isn't whether or not you can make judgments. The question is, are your judgments true? Jesus said in John 7:24, stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. Everybody makes judgments. You got to make a judgment to be a Christian, don't you? Got to make a judgment to be a non-Christian. I will say this, though, about judging. Jesus did save a very stern rebuke for people who were judgmental. And who were the judgmental ones in his day? The Pharisees, right? And who were the Pharisees? They were the religious and political leaders of Israel. And Jesus went after them. By the way, he wasn't so nice doing it. You ever hear somebody say, oh, that guy is such a saint. He's never said a bad word about anyone. Well, if that's the definition of a saint, Jesus was no saint. Just read Matthew chapter 23. What does he say in Matthew chapter 23 to these scribes and Pharisees, these religious and political leaders? Are you telling me Jesus got involved in politics? Yes! He went after the political leaders. And here's what he said in Matthew chapter 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you brood of vipers, you hypocrites. You strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Oh, you look great on the outside. You're whitewashed tombs, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. You go a mile to make a convert, and then once you make them a convert, you make them twice as much a son of hell as you are. How will you avoid being condemned to hell? What? Sweet and gentle Jesus said this? Yes, Jesus was not Barney. Can't we all just get along, girl, boys and girls? No! I came to bring a sword. It's going to divide father and son, mother and daughter. What? No, I'm not saying we're hostile. I'm just saying we're going to stand for the truth. He wasn't Mr. Rogers. He didn't go around saying this sermon brought to you by the letter E. Jesus was tough. And sometimes you just got to tell people directly that they're wrong. If not, you're enabling them. You want to love somebody? Don't tolerate the evil they do. You don't tolerate in your kids, do you? If your kid wants to do something evil, it's not loving to tolerate that. It's loving to say, don't do that because you're going to hurt yourself and other people. By the way, I've noticed one other thing about judging. Recently, you ever notice that when you compliment somebody, which is a judgment. Nobody gets upset. Like if I say to Dr. Land, Dr. Land, you're doing a great job as the president of SES here. What a wonderful school. Look at this great conference. You're just doing a super job. You think he's going to say, who do you think you are? Are you judging me? You think you're worse than me? No, he's never going to say that. Why? I've noticed that people don't have any problem with judging. They just have a problem with judgments they don't like. And if you say something that's true to somebody and they get upset and you say it in a nice way, you just help convict them. As Augustine said, we love the truth when it enlightens us. We hate the truth when it convicts us. Jesus said, men love darkness rather than light. You tell somebody something that's true and they're upset, you're what we say in the military, you're over the target. You always get more flack when you're over the target. All right, here's the one thinking skill. Let's sum this up. Notice that atheists and other non-believers exempt themselves from their own theories. And so what you want to do, you want to point out that the laws of logic are undeniable. As soon as you think about anything, you're using them. And if you try and deny them, you're using them. And so what you want to do to stop the silliness is to turn the claim on itself. Turn the claim on itself. All right. I don't have time to talk to you about Pascal, but let's sum this up. If you want to go further, the books and DVDs are available on the book table in the back, crossexamine.org, and all the proceeds from the sale of the books and the DVDs will go to feed needy children. Mine. And just so you know. In fact, one of them you're going to hear from tomorrow. He's doing a talk on Islamic terror groups. He's in the Air Force. His name is Zach. He's doing a session here tomorrow afternoon. So if you want to check that out. He's already gone to the seminary himself. He's taken online courses in the military. Why haven't you? Come on. If you want this presentation, go to this website, crossexamine.org/NCCA. Type that in your browser. Send us an email. We're going to send it to you. And we'll send you this presentation, the one I'm going to do tomorrow, Jorge Gill's presentation. We're going to send you Zach's presentation. You got to send us an email. We're not going to give your email address to anybody else, but send that to us, and we'll send it right back to you. We're teaching some online courses, and so is SES. If you haven't taken an online course, you need to take them. You can do it right from the comfort of your own home. We're on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Like our Facebook page, crossexamine.org. It's cross-examined with a D on the end of it. You'll get all our streaming events on campus and a lot of short videos you can share with anybody. In fact, we're so into YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, we've combined these three into one social media platform. We call it YouTwitface. It's kind of a Jersey thing. We're on radio on Saturdays on the American Family Radio Network, one of the sponsors here, 185 stations around the country. That's on the app as well, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And we're on DirecTV, another sponsor, NRB-TV. NRB-TV, right here, a booth outside. You want to check them out. The best apologetic and Christian programming you'll find anywhere. It's DirecTV Channel 378. It's also available on Roku. Okay, Roku. And it's also available on our website, crossexamine.org. Wednesday nights, 9 p.m. And then, if you don't do anything else, get the free app. Two words in the App Store, cross-examined. Cross-examined, two words in the App Store. Over 140,000 people have downloaded. It's got the TV show on there, the radio program, and a quick answer section, including many of the things we've just been through here. You don't have to have all this stuff memorized. You got the quick answer section. So you could just go to your phone if somebody has an objection right there and get a response at your fingertips. And why do you want to do this? Because, as Jesus said, the truth will set you free. If you don't have the truth, you're in bondage, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let's go to our next session. See you later. We're done.